According to Charles C. Mann, it wasn't 1492, but the year that followed that really played a pivotal role in the creation of the New World. Mr. Mann's latest book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created, explores the explorer's second journey, which prompted the exchange of not only information, but also food, animals, insects, plants, and viruses between the continents. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Charles Mann, who is a correspondent for The Atlantic, Science, and Wired, back to our show today. Welcome.
I'm very pleased to be here.
In one of your previous books, you explore the year 1492, and now... and so you've done the year before and the year after 14. I mean, you did 1491. I'm sorry, I messed that up. But so you've done the year before and the year after 1492. Is 1492 the least interesting of the 3 years?
Well, no. But I like the idea that 1491 sort of stands for everything before Columbus, and 1493 stands for everything after Columbus. And the idea is that he change the world in ways that are just so large that we're still dealing with them.
Your approach to history seems to focus on this pivotal moment, and then you follow the rippling butterfly effects into the present day. Can one single year remain so important 5 centuries later?
Not so much the year, but the fact that what Columbus did, if you're a scientist, if you're a biologist who's thinking about it, is that 250 million years ago, I think we all learned this in school, there was a single giant continent, Pangaea.
And that's how you begin your book.
Right. And geological forces broke it up. And as a result, the different continents developed completely different suites of plants and animals. And what Columbus did was bring them all together. He recreated Pangaea. And that was, you know, an earth-shattering event that we're still dealing with.
Although it's very likely that the Vikings visited North America, possibly Basque fishermen as well. But
oh,
they didn't have much of an impact.
Yeah. What Columbus did was inaugurate, if you like, consequential and sustained contact between them. You know, they came up to the north. They were there for a few years. It was a kind of an unpromising area.
And you write that 1493 was a tremendous ecological convulsion, the greatest event in the history of life since the death of the dinosaurs. And the way you describe it, I'm not sure that even the dinosaurs stack up.
Well, it was a very big deal. What these ecosystems that have been separate for millions of years suddenly mixed and collided. And the collision not only had a huge effect on the history of life, but a huge effect on the history of humans.
Is Columbus the most important European in this story?
I think so. Again, it's not so much for what he was consciously trying to do. It's what happened in the wake of his voyages.
Because then we have all of these, the conquistadors,
yes,
and other explorers. And you draw upon their writings as well and their histories. Unfortunately, much of what of the writings that preceded them were destroyed.
Right. There's a lot of native societies, particularly, you know, south of the border, south of the Rio Grande, that had writing systems of their own. There's about a dozen writing systems in Mesoamerica, and then there was a kind of a complicated record-keeping system in the Andes. And these were largely destroyed by the conquistadors. But enough remains that we can piece together the history. And in fact, one of the things that's really been exciting in the last 20 or 30 years has been the decipherment of the Maya hieroglyphics. So we really know a lot about these societies now.
Well, only four books... Mayan books survived.
Right, absolutely.
And this was, is this because the Christian conquistadors considered all of this paganism? Or is how much of this is a clash of civilizations, the sort of thing that we're talking about today?
Quite a bit of it. For instance, these quipu, which were these records that were made by knotting strings together, really unusual form of communication. And in fact, scholars argue about whether it was writing or, you know, something like this can be described as writing. What happened, the records were detailed enough that native people in the Andes started suing the Spaniards to get their land back. And they would haul out these records, and they started winning the lawsuits. And at that point, it became obvious that they were satanic and they had to be destroyed. So that in addition to being clash of civilization, it was a simple power struggle between these elite groups.
They went further. They enslaved people who had created great civilizations.
Oh, yeah. And but, you know, I think if you look back at human history, this isn't really uncommon. You know, slavery was pretty much everywhere in the world to a greater or lesser degree at that time. And if you read the Native Chronicles, they don't. You never see them blaming the Spaniards for acting this way because they felt this is sort of human nature. They regret, obviously, being in this position, but they're not surprised.
My guest is Charles C. Mann, whose latest book is 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, one of the names we're not as familiar with, but you reveal is rather important, is Francisco Eguia.
Yes, he was the Spaniard who is thought to have carried smallpox to the Americas. And the reason this is particularly important is that the Americas, by a quirk of ecological history, had very few of the what they call diseases of the crowd, diseases that can go, spread through the air and jump from people to person to person. And this kind of epidemic disease basically did not exist in the Americas. And the Columbian Exchange, among other things, brought it over. And the results were catastrophic. Between 1500 and 1650, these diseases killed somewhere between two-thirds and nine-tenths of the people in the Americas.
And not just human-borne diseases, but diseases that were carried by some of the animals who were being brought from Europe?
Yeah, a very big example is yellow fever, which is a virus that's originally from Africa, came over in the ships along with the mosquito that carries it, Aedes aegypti, and played a huge role in the history of the Caribbean.
I got the sense in my high school history classes that the Americas were generally underpopulated, which made it easier for the European arrivals to claim large swaths of it. But you write, when the Europeans came up, I'm quoting, it was as if all the deaths over the millennium caused by these diseases were compressed into 150 years in the Americas. The result was to wipe out between two-thirds and 90% of the people in the Americas. It was the worst demographic disaster in history.
Absolutely. There's really nothing else that compares with it in that way. And obviously it was much easier for small groups of Europeans at the end of long supply chains to come into societies that have been shattered by disease. Alfred Crosby, who is the man who invented the term Columbian Exchange and whose work I am obviously significantly indebted to, pointed out that had the Genghis Khan come to Europe immediately after the Black Death, you and I would not be speaking an Indo-European language. He would have just rolled right in, and more or less that's what happened to the Americas.
Well, this doesn't sound like a very positive result of early globalization.
It wasn't intentional.
Tom Friedman about this?
It wasn't intentional. I mean, neither side had a germ theory of disease at the time. It was, and both sides, in fact, reacted to disease and its aftermath more like each other than we would, than either would be like us today. Both sides thought of this as, some dispensation from providence, from the heavens, and, there is no blame attached to it.
Aren't there some historians who disagree with you over the numbers?
Well, this is a contentious issue, and by that I think you mean how big the populations were.
Yeah.
And
you're suggesting that the so-called New World, I don't know what we should call it.
The Americas.
Okay, the Americas were fairly largely populated, maybe even in some cases comparable to Europe.
Yeah, I think if you sort of step back and look, in the 1960s, there's a belief that there's just really a few million people in the Americas. And then a group of historians, very prominent in that name is Henry Dobbins, late Henry Dobbins, put together colonial records and said, wait a minute, this picture we're seeing from colonial records really isn't consonant with the idea that there's a small number of people here. And I think very few people today in the field believe that there are as few as back then. The question is how many more? And a typical estimates, I think, are 40 to 60 million. Obviously, this is a very squishy kind of number. You can cavil at it, but I think that that's generally speaking, most people in the field would accept something like that.
And is the traditional view of historians that Western superiority in organization and weaponry was the reason that they prevailed? Is that still the prevailing theory?
Well, I think they would say it's much more complicated than that. If you look at the history of European attempts to colonize the Americas, almost none of them succeeded absent disease. Now, obviously, guns, especially the later guns developed in the 17th century, are superior to bows and arrows and so forth. But
they brought horses as well.
And so, and there was new kinds of battle techniques and a whole host of innovations. But the fact remains that absent disease, the Europeans very rarely succeeded. There's a whole host of attempts to plant colonies in North America, for example, before the first epidemics, which occurred in about 1617. And they're French, they're Spanish, they're even Dutch, they're English, and none of them succeeded, with the exception of Jamestown, which 80% of the people died.
And Jamestown, you say, was originally conceived on the Spanish model to find gold.
Right.
And there was no gold.
Well, the idea was, you know, it's being founded. Cortez has found vast sums of gold in Mexico. Pizarro has found huge amounts of silver and gold in the Andes. Here's North America. Clearly, it's got to be the same thing. So they're looking for two things. First was the precious metals, and the second was a quick passage to China. They wanted to cut through the North America and go to China, which is where the action was.
Well, what they should have done at Jamestown was continue westward and gone to the Pacific coast, and they might have found some gold.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they did find tobacco.
Right.
So that became the gold of the American South?
Yeah. Tobacco, actually, it's interesting. That's a species originally from Amazonia. There wasn't a North American tobacco, but it was not thought to be as pleasant. And so they brought in this species from Amazonia, and it became the first worldwide commodity craze. You know, there's this extraordinary records of people all over the world in the early 17th century saying, what is this stuff that our people like so much? And, you know, from the Mughal Empire to the formation of smoking clubs by juvenile delinquents in Japan at the time. And Virginia found itself ideally situated to export this stuff, this wonderful, intoxicating, louche, pleasurable thing that everybody that was disdained by stuffy authority to the English. And by the time of Jamestown, which started in 1607, there's a count that there are 7,000 tobacco houses, in London.
So perhaps this is the American revenge on the Europeans.
Lung cancer, you mean.
1493 is Charles C. Mann's latest book. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Charles C. Mann. His book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It's published by Knopf. I want to return to the whole business of how populated the New World was at the time, because that seems to be a key to everything that follows here. You cite the writings of Verrazano, of some of the Spanish conquistadors, Bartolomé de las Casas, but also Gaspar de Carvajal, who also gave us the idea of these Amazonian warriors, women warriors. So how much can we rely on what they wrote?
Well, there's two forms of evidence. First is, as you say, the colonial accounts. And there is a couple of historians from California who summed it up succinctly. They said, one thing 16th century Spaniards could do, they knew how to count. And if you start reading these accounts in which they're consistently reporting large numbers of people, you can start giving credence to that. The second form of evidence, and in fact the one that pushed people back towards the chronicles, was the archaeological findings. And in, for example, in the Amazon, which was for a long time thought to be basically empty of any kind of archaeological remains, over the last 20 or 30 years, groups, there's a wonderful group called the Central Amazon Project in about 1,200 miles up the river, for example, have found large-scale human societies, you know, areas that have been affected by the human presence. And so when you put these two forms of evidence together, it starts looking more and more like the Spaniards were right.
Now, the Spaniards imposed European ideas upon the people they'd conquered. Mm-hmm. Did they take any of the ideas that they found back? For example, in Mesoamerica, there was rather sophisticated agriculture, terraced farms, etc. Did they understand what they were seeing there?
No. I mean, there's real culture blindness there. And one of my favorite examples is Mexico City was built on top of the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, which was a city much like Venice, built on these artificial islands in the middle of an artificially drained lake. And it used engineering principles that the Spaniards weren't familiar with. They'd never done that kind of thing. And when they took the place, they effectively killed all the engineers, and they then spent the next two centuries trying to reconstruct what the Aztecs had done, and they failed. They took back, however, the most important things probably that they took back were the potato and maize, which is what people outside the U.S. call corn, and that led to huge changes in European life.
Also tomatoes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chocolate, vanilla, chilies, turkeys.
Right. You name it, they came from there. The difference was for those two particular crops, potatoes and maize, is that when they came to Europe and they were really spread around in the early in the 17th century, they basically ended hunger in Europe. And, you know, there's a growing number of historians who say, wait a minute, Europe would never have been able to take over the rest of the world in the way that it did if it had been beset by food riots and the kind of thing that they had had at home.
It is interesting to see which areas found favor,
yeah,
or which things found favor in which areas. The potato, not so much in Italy, but in fact in Eastern Europe, and then in Ireland to some degree.
Yeah, there's
Spain.
A potato belt. There's a broad belt from Ukraine to potato, from Ukraine to Ireland, where you know that's the potato land. And in fact, more potatoes are grown there than grown in Peru, where the potato came from. And then sweet potato came to China much before the potato, and China to this day grows 3/4 of the sweet potatoes in the world.
I once told somebody from Thailand that there were no chilies in Thailand before 1492, and he called me a dirty liar because it's become so much a part of the Thai culture. And that's something we don't talk much about. Much of the Columbian Exchange discussion is about what the Europeans brought to the New World, what the New World sent back. But there was also a lot of exchange across the Pacific.
Yeah, and that's part of my book, is that it came across something that I found completely fascinating called the galleon trade. And the idea was that the most important thing that Spain discovered in the New World was a mountain of silver in southern Bolivia in a place called Potosi, the largest silver strike ever, just a staggering amount of silver. And the Chinese, for reasons to go into if you want to, had a huge hunger for silver, and they basically started pulling boats across the Chinese demand, not literally the Chinese. And on those boats, on these galleons, which went once a year from Mexico full of silver to the Philippines where they met Chinese boats, rode a whole host of other creatures and had an enormous impact in Asian history.
As I understand it, the people in Mesoamerica were not as excited by gold as the Europeans were. Jade was the important thing to them, and jade was perhaps the most valued stone in China.
Yeah.
Any idea of why that is?
Different cultures assign value differently. It's, you know, the Chinese were completely fascinated by silver, but, you know, and were willing to pay more for silver than anybody else in the world, but were much less interested in gold. And in fact, there are lots of Spaniards that would take gold from the Americas, sell it in Europe for more than the Chinese are willing to pay it, and take silver from the Americans, sell it to China for more than the Europeans were able to pay it, and play this kind of arbitrage. And that went on for hundreds of years.
You mentioned that it's really Columbus's second voyage.
Yes.
That is the key. The first voyage, he just sailed around and noticed that there were these islands. And
right. And the second voyage, he decided, okay, we're going to put a settlement here. We're going to erect a city, and he erected this city called La Isabela, which is on the opposite side. It's on Hispaniola, which is the island that Haiti and the Dominican Republic are. And this was going to be his entrepot, his trade depot, where he was then going to go to China and Japan, which he erroneously believed were right around the corner, and do the trading from. And there,
and what did he bring?
He brought a whole host of domestic animals. He brought cattle. He brought horses. He brought wheat. He brought all these crops to plant because he was going to create this little bit of Spain there. And that was the sort of opening salvo in this kind of ecological invasion of the Americas. And now something like 2/3 of the plants and animals species in Hispaniola, in Dominican Republic and Haiti, are actually from foreign places.
And it changed all of the Americas.
Yes.
Because in Mesoamerica, they had a very limited sources of protein, ate mostly fish and some game birds.
No, they had maize, they had corn, and they had sweet potatoes. So they were actually doing okay, But the point is, suddenly you bring in wheat, for example. Suddenly you bring in rice. You bring in all these other crops. And in fact, one of the things that happens, these effects multiply each other. They bring in, not only do they bring in Africans, you know, in fact, most of the people who came to the Americas before 1800 were Africans. They outnumbered Europeans something 3-1. But the Africans then bring African rice, and they bring African grasses. They bring, and, you know, unfortunately, they also bring African diseases. So these different types of people come in, and they create these cascading ecological effects.
But it works both ways,
absolutely,
doesn't it? Isn't, don't many people believe that syphilis came from the Americas, or is a variant of something that came from the Americas?
Yes, but it turns out that the, in terms of diseases, you know, the only significant disease that appears to have crossed the Atlantic the other way was syphilis, and syphilis is fascinating. Anything venereal is, of course, fascinating, but it's not a game changer the way smallpox is, the way malaria is, the way some, you know, these other measles, these other, you know, large scale infections are.
And the Europeans realize that something like smallpox could have such an impact. Lord Geoffrey Amherst is credited with spreading smallpox.
Yeah, I live in Amherst, Massachusetts. I live in this town named after this guy, which is sort of amazing. In sort of in as a parenthesis, sort of in his defense, I have to say he was a very inept smallpox spreader. He didn't really want to do it. He kind of was talked into it, and it didn't work very well. He's not going to ever win any humanitarian prizes, but he wasn't a major figure. But yes, the spread of these diseases, that was the first wave of the Columbian exchange, and the import was disproportionately felt in the Americas. And one way to think of it, you know, if you're a scientist, is that what Columbus did was change permanently the distribution of the human species on the planet. Before, you know, in 1492, almost all Europeans lived in Europe. All Native people, Native Americans, lived in the Americas. The vast majority of Chinese lived in China, and so on. After Columbus, you know, quite soon this starts to change. You get huge numbers of Africans in the Americas. This dramatic decline of Indians in the Americas, and then these scattered pockets of Europeans and Chinese all over the place. And it's essentially the distribution of people in the modern world.
I read that the Sioux came into the Great Plains around 1492.
Well, it's very complicated. You know, yeah.
So it isn't just the Europeans who are coming into these different places.
Absolutely.
There's constant movement. Well, there was the Asian invasion into the Americas in the first place, but also people are moving around and then claiming a certain area as their traditional homeland, even if they arrived fairly recently.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very human phenomenon. One of the things that I ended up actually devoting very little time to in the book, just simply because you can't, was something I found completely fascinating. Spaniards bring horses, Indians realize immediately how useful they are, and they start stealing them, you know, basically the instant that they arrive. And, of course, the Spaniards want them back, and they start pushing them to the areas that the Spaniards aren't, and they're pushing them north. And Native groups all over the Great Plains realize that this was a game-changing, you know, invention from their point of view. Because if you're a small farming village and people on horses come to you, you can't move around the way they can. You're just a sitting duck. And this is sort of what Eastern Europeans discovered when Genghis Khan came in. And so there was a kind of arms race as societies all over the American West ran south to grab the horse. And the Comanches, essentially, you know, these incredible horsemen, were created in this moment. They migrated all the way from near the Canadian border down and created this kind of empire there based on the control of this foreign resource.
One major development as a result of the Columbian Exchange is fusion cooking everywhere.
Yeah,
I don't know where it had more of an impact in the Americas or in Europe, but it's interesting to note that in the Americas, pretty much everything that came from Europe was accepted, whereas in Europe, some people said, I'll never eat a tomato.
Absolutely.
Others said, I'll never eat this corn.
Yeah.
Or
we'll
give it to the pigs.
Potato was quite a hard sell, it turns out. It's sort of
until
funny.
Until they learned how to make vodka from it?
It surely can't have hurt. But, you know, in England, for example, the potato was somehow associated with these sort of hated Catholics, you know, Spain. And so there was actually campaigns against it. No potatoes, no popery was the slogan. And in Russia, the Orthodox priest said, wait a minute, this is bad. Potatoes are not mentioned in the Bible, which is indisputably true. And so you can't have food that's not mentioned in the Bible.
And the French resisted corn and tomatoes, but embraced chocolate and vanilla.
Well, I mentioned this to a French friend of mine. He said, it shows good taste.
But they were all great.
Yeah, they were all great. And it was just that, you know, there, for example, the potato is a tuber, and Europeans just simply weren't familiar with tuber crops. It seemed very strange to them. I mean, they eventually caught on, but it took famines. And in France, for example, almost a kind of government program. There's this guy named Parmentier who was charged by the king to do all kinds of demonstration plots and PR stunts for these. And one of the most effective, supposedly, was it's unclear how much of this is myth, was that he cultivated a potato plot and left it unguarded, and starving peasants stole the potatoes, and in this way they were spread to the poor.
I mentioned that your approach is kind of like the rippling butterfly effect. Are we seeing the process still in progress today?
Oh, absolutely. The Columbian Exchange, the echoes of it are going to be with us for a long time. I mean, every time that you read in the newspaper about, right here in Central Park, you have the Asian longhorn beetle, I believe, a recent immigrant. When citrus prices from the Dominican Republic go up because the swallowtail butterfly has come in from Asia, when trees in the West are hit, there's that kind of ecological invasion is still going today. But also, one of the places I traveled for the book was Laos, and Laos and Vietnam are being taken over by the Brazilian rubber tree, creating these gigantic rubber plantations. And it's a huge areas of tropical forest are being changed in this way.
And we have coffee being brought into the Americas and becoming a major part of the South American economies. Less so today, interestingly, but
there's an awful lot of coffee
in Brazil.
Yeah, coffee was for 150 years Brazil's most important export. Another one was bananas, which come from Africa. And now Brazil, which is the home of rubber, produces practically no natural rubber.
Because it was stolen away, or because the ecology is changing?
Well, it depends on whether you ask a Brazilian or American.
Yeah, there was a time when Brazil, when that was actually a secret, and it was illegal to take a rubber tree out of Brazil.
In fact, if you go to Brazil, you'll find it's quite easy to find denunciations of Henry Wickham, the man who took rubber out of Brazil and created these rubber plantations in Southeast Asia. He is the first biopirate.
So you have written 1491, now 1493. What's next, 1495?
Oh, no, I've run out of numbers. I don't. My daughter would like me to write a children's book about Bill and Fred, these two Japanese beetles that are the heroes of some of the stories that I've told her. She wants to provide the illustrations. I haven't told my publisher this, though.
Meanwhile, you have the things you write for The Atlantic, Science, and Wired.
Yeah.
And other publications. And there is this book, a lot of fun to read, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. It is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, it's a pleasure.